Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
How do you reinvent the Greek myths? Or more specifically, if you're Stephen Fry, how do you reinvent the Greek myths? Stephen Fry will be here to talk about his latest book, Heroes, The Greek Myths Reimagined. Which books can readers turn to get a deeper understanding of issues around race and racism in America? My colleagues Lauren Christensen and Andrew LaValle will join us to discuss. Alexander Alter will give us an update from the publishing world. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's June 12th. I'm Pamela Paul. Stephen Fry joins us now from the countryside in England. His newest book is called Heroes, The Greek Myths Reimagined. Stephen, thank you so much for being here.
It's a real pleasure, Pamela. Nice to talk to you.
I don't usually do this, but I am going to start with a little bit of gushing on a somewhat different topic, but it's a literary topic at least. I remember first seeing you in the film Wild when it came out in 1997. I was living in London at the time, and I had only recently read Richard Ellman's biography of Wilde. And I know you're a huge fan of Oscar Wilde. I'm just curious, if you talk a little bit about how you came to his work as a reader and as an actor.
Well, I'll tell you, it is a strange story in a way, a rather appealing one, I suppose. I grew up in exactly the same part of the countryside where I'm currently sheltering in place. And it was miles, as the great wizened divine Sidney Smith said, simply miles from the nearest lemon. In other words, deep in the countryside, far from shops and civilization, and even from libraries. My parents were both, you know, academically very advanced. My father's a physicist, my mother a historian. And so there were lots of books. But every 2 weeks or so, a mobile library would come trundling along, a sort of van or truck would come along, and about a quarter of a mile from the house would park on the corner of two lanes. And I would trot along and get on. And I remember one Sunday, I was watching television, which was a very rare thing indeed for me because my father didn't approve of it. And we had only a tiny little black and white set kept in a cupboard, which would come out for royal weddings or the death of Churchill or the moon landing or things of great significance, but otherwise was really locked away like the madwoman in the attic that my father regarded television as being, and probably rightly. Anyway, it was raining and he was out working, and he had a laboratory in the stable blocks of the house. He was a sort of, as I say, an inventor physicist. And I saw this film, and people in it, I was about 10 or 11 years old, people were speaking in the most remarkable way that I'd ever heard. I couldn't quite believe what I was listening to. There was a young man who said to a girl, "I hope I will not in any way offend you if I say that you seem to me to be the visible personification of absolute perfection." And I remember thinking, what? And it was such a phrase that I had to repeat it and repeat it. And I knew it wasn't Shakespeare, and I knew it wasn't 20th century, but I couldn't quite work out what it was. So after it was finished, I ran to my mother and I said, "Mother, I hope I will not offend you if I say that you seem to me to be in every way the visible personification of absolute perfection." She said, "I beg your pardon." And I explained to her what I'd been watching. And when she eventually unpicked my breathless gushing about this thing, she said, "Oh, that was the importance of being earnest." And there wasn't a copy of it in the house. My parents had a fire in one of the book rooms, and probably it had been destroyed. So I waited for the library to come. This is a very long answer to your question.
I love it.
And I got on and I said to the little librarian woman who had sort of half moon spectacles and beads and powdery cheeks, I said, "Do you have anything by Oscar Wilde?" And she said, "Oh, yes, we've got the plays of Oscar Wilde." And so I took them home and I read the four great comedies, you know, Woman of No Importance, and Lady Windermere's Fan, and the and the importance of being asked, of course. And I just became obsessed by it. I kept the book for about 2 or 3 weeks and then went back to the library and asked if they had any more. And then I got the complete works, and I read such of those as I could understand, some of the political essays and other such things. The more philosophical works were obviously a bit beyond me, but I was the children's fairy tales and other things. I just loved reading them. And then I went back and said, "Have you got anything more?" And she said, "Well, that was the complete works. There won't be any more." And then I spotted, and I looked around the shelves. I saw a book called The Trials of Oscar Wilde. I said, "Oh, I'll take that." She said, "Well, I think you might be a bit young for that." I said, no, honestly, I read very much above my age," or something like that. She said, "Well, all right then." And she stamped the book and I took it and I read about this extraordinary man, this generous, warm-hearted, almost messianic. He had disciples, friends, a circle of people. He was so charming and extraordinary. And then with my heart thumping, I read about his fall. And even at that age, I knew that this was something that connected to me. I wouldn't have articulated that I was gay. Well, not, we didn't use the word back then in the 1960s or early 70s, whenever it was. But I just knew that this was me. And suddenly, I connected him with everything that I loved in terms of language, because the importance had shown me that this thing we you and I are using now, this thing we use to exchange and to ask someone to pass the salt or to pick up a phone and order a pizza or whatever, this same thing can be used to beguile and seduce and delight and entrance, and can be used as a painter uses paint or a dancer uses their body. It is something so remarkable, language, and Wilde brought that alive to me, which was very important because I couldn't sing or dance and I was hopeless at athletics or sports of any kind and I couldn't sing. So I suddenly realised all I had was my language, and that I was perhaps unique amongst my friends in thinking that language was something important, that it was for more than just the exchange of ideas or, as I say, for the asking someone to pass the mustard. So Wilde taught me that, but at the same time, he taught me that there was something dark and terrible in store for me in my future life, because I started to read about his friends and look through bibliographies, you know, the way you do in the days before hyperlinks.
Right, right. The Encyclopedia Britannica. And
exactly. And indexes and the card index of a library where you can just join dots and make connections. And so I found out about all of Wilde's friends and people who were influenced by him. And so many of them, of course, were gay, and so many of them ended their lives either in disgrace or in sort of alcoholic ruin in, you know, in Tangier or with Paul Bowles and, you know, a set of decadent figures in Capri or somewhere like that. And it was both glamorous and enchanting, but also slightly frightening. So Wilde was everything to me. He opened the door to literature. He showed me the way in, and that changed my life completely, but it was also personal. So the idea that I would ever play him in a film, of course, was just absolutely out. But it was the British playwright and wonderful figure, Alan Bennett. I was in Joe Allen's in London, and he just passed by my table, and he said, I've been watching you. He said, and you know, you've grown your hair, and you should play Oscar Wilde one day. You look just like him, and you've got the mannerisms. And then he drifted away, and I thought, it had never occurred to me. And then I looked at myself in the mirror, and I parted my hair in the middle. I thought, oh, maybe I do.
Well, that's like a prophecy. What year was that?
Yes, that's right. I mean, that was about 5 years before the film happened. And then it all sort of, I got in, you know, asked if I would take part in this film. And, you know, I mean, as an actor, as Clint Eastwood says in, I think it's in Magnum Force, he says to Hal Holbrook, a man's got to know his limitations. And it's particularly true of an actor. I think you've got to know your limitations. And I always knew I was never going to get the parts that Brad Pitt had just turned down. But maybe there would be the odd part that could be more than just a, you know, a villain or a sort of comic silly character or something. And that Wilde was one such where I could actually play a lead.
I'm not surprised that Alan Bennett somehow figured into that story, but the idea that Clint Eastwood would somehow enter in, I didn't expect, I have to admit.
I have a wide palette of references.
Did you, when you say that, you know, he opened you up to language, reading his work, did that affect you at that point? You were, as you said, 10 or 11 years old. Did that affect you primarily as a reader, or also did you start to write at that time?
No, it did as a writer as well. There's something about his rhythms, which are so exquisite And indeed, that's a very Wildian thing to say, exquisite rather than exquisite. I found that I could learn the language of Wilde's sentences, whole paragraphs from The Importance to start with and then with from other works, simply because the rhythms of them sat in the brain exactly right. In the same way as you can't rewrite the opening bars of Beethoven's Fifth, you know, it wouldn't make sense. That's the way the notes fall. So it is in that sort of writing. It gives you a template for the prosodic word is the quantity of language, the actual weight and heft of a particular word in the sentence and how a sentence swings and changes. And then other writers, some of them, in fact, there were my World Wide Web, my WWW, when I was a teenager, were on the light side of things, P.G. Wodehouse, who was a magnificent prose master, and Evelyn Waugh, the British novelist, a male Evelyn. He wrote Brideshead Revisited and Decline and Fall and many extraordinary satirical novels. And again, an absolute master of prose. And those three, perhaps with the addition, oddly, from an earlier age as a child, again, a marvellous kind of magisterial prose master was Arthur Conan Doyle. I used to love Sherlock Holmes. And there was something about that language, too. It was sort of marmoreal, you know. It had a kind of permanence, it's a rightness, it sat in the ear. And I think those sort of writers always appealed to me. Cyril Connolly, who was a great critic, founded Horizon magazine, and he was a friend of all the writers of the Bloomsbury Group and many others in the 20th century. He wrote a book called Enemies of Promise, in the first half of which he talks about two types of writing. He talks about Mandarin and non-Mandarin. And what he's talking about prose aesthetics. And of course, the biggest thing to happen to English prose in the 20th century probably was Ernest Hemingway, who was an enormous influence on a great many writers. I have nothing but the profoundest admiration for Hemingway, but it's not the way I could ever use language. I can't be that simple, that fantastically bald, use those sort of repetitions. I mean, Nick saw the fish saw Nick.
Right.
You know, all that. It's brilliant when you read it. And that contrasts exactly with what Connolly called the Mandarin, which is the florid, the orotund, the wordy. And in fact, even we're going to come on to these books on Greek myths at one point, but funny enough, when I was writing the first one, Mythos, I was about halfway through it when I suddenly heard through a friend that our mutual friend, Neil Gaiman, the writer, had just finished writing a book on Norse mythology. And I was terrified to think that maybe he was doing a series and that his next one would be Greek mythology, which I was writing. So I wrote to Neil, whom I know, and I said, Neil, I've just heard that you've written this book. Apparently it's marvellous. I can't wait to read it, of course. And then I explained my quandary. I said, do I give up writing this book on Greek myth? He said, no, don't worry. And he sent me an early manuscript of his, or, you know, PDFs, of course, as they are now, of the book. And I, in my reply to him, I said, your spare, wondrous storytelling fits the Norse world so well. I'm hoping that my profligate, frankly, harlotish style of writing, its floridity, its fullness, suits the Mediterranean, you know, profusion of the Greek world, because I can't write like you, but I so admire it. And we batted back and forth a bit about that. And it's a thing a writer has to understand. I mean, you know, particularly America, because Hemingway was American and was of such influence, but thriller writers, and I'm a huge admirer, incidentally, of someone like Lee Child and his Jack Reach books. And when he started, you could see he quite deliberately it was his first book. And there he is stripping it of every adverb. And Stephen King wrote a book, didn't he, about his style guide, as it were?
Yes, on writing.
And again, you know, no adverbs, no this, no that. And I've tried to do that with my writing, and I thought, no, it's no good, Stephen. This is the writer you are, and if people think it's overwritten, if they think it's over-florid, then so be it. They'll have to put the book down and turn to someone with a spare style. But I can't do it. I just can't. And unfortunately, enough people don't mind to allow me to carry on that way.
Well, Greek mythology seems made for the Mandarin style, and maybe even for Wilde and that influence. But you've written memoirs, you've written novels. What made you sit down and think what I really need to do is rewrite or write a version of the Greek myths?
It was a moment at I was having dinner with some friends, and I can't remember how the subject came up, but someone was talking about, you know, it wasn't an over pretentious dinner party discussion, but it was about the way different cultures explain how the world came to be. And, you know, we were saying, is Genesis a terrible myth? Is it all about guilt and shame? And are there better ones? And so I started to talk about, you know, the Greek origin myths, and then went back a bit to the, you know, out of chaos and Uranus and Gaia. And everyone started staring at me and saying, go on. I said, well, you know, and then I get the next generation, and I was talking, you know, about Kronos and then the birth of Zeus. And so, and they were going, wow, how do you know all this? And I said, well, I used to love Greek myths. And a lot of them were very, far more intelligent than I, and probably better read. But they knew the names. Everyone knows the names Zeus and Apollo and so on. But they hadn't joined the dots. And it's a miraculous thing about Greek mythology that there is a timeline and a chronology. I mean, it's probably reverse engineered by Hesiod and Homer and the later poets, obviously. But nonetheless, it has a shape, a beginning and an end, which other mythic structures don't seem to have. And they're so deep in the, I hesitate to use such a cliche, but I can't avoid it, in the DNA of our own culture and art, that it's kind of part of who we are. So they encouraged me, really, and a lot of people said, you've got to retell those stories. And at first I thought I'd do it as a stage show, and then I started writing it and realized what pleasure it was to research and go back to some of the sources that I remember and find out and fill in the gaps that in my own knowledge that I started writing.
Did that mobile library play a part in your early reading of the Greek myths as well?
Yes, it did. And funnily enough, it was American mythologists who were the biggest influence on me when I was young, apart from Robert Graves, who was hugely influential, mm-hmm. who wrote a magnificent two-volume edition of the Greek myths. But for when I was younger and too young for Robert Graves, it was Edith Hamilton and Bernard Evslin and a Bullfinch. We had a copy of Bullfinch, which is American, I think, isn't it? The Bullfinch mythology. And Nathaniel Hawthorne, whom I remember well reading those when I was very young. I had a big illustrated version of Nathaniel Hawthorne's Tanglewood Tales. And these were all wonderful retellings for children. And there was a British author called Roger Lancelin Green, whom I also read as a boy. And at school, because I loved classics at school from a very early age. We were taught Latin from the age of seven at my school, and I did so well at it, only because I think I did so badly at everything else, that I was put onto ancient Greek quite young too. I was 8 or 9 when I started learning ancient Greek, which I loved. And so those stories, of course, are the things you use for translations. And so I grew up with a lot of them.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned Edith Hamilton, because I was sent your new book, Heroes, and my 15-year-old daughter was already a super fan of Mythos, the first book, which came out a couple of years ago. And I asked her, well, what is it that you like that Stephen Fry does in these books? Because she's one of those kids that has read the Greek myths in many incarnations. And she said, well, it's very different from Edith Hamilton. And one of the differences and the things that I like best, and this surprised me, she said, the footnotes. She said, normally you don't want to read footnotes, but here you actually do. And it's funny because you had written, I think, in the introduction to Heroes, that plenty of readers enjoyed them the first time around, that you thought that they might be annoying. I just talk about the footnotes and your decision around that.
They're such an interesting instrument, footnotes. They are a way of having an intimate conversation with the reader, which is of a different order to the kind you have in the main body of the prose or the text. And I don't know why that is. I use them because one of the things I find so deeply fascinating about Greek myths is that you can start to tell the story and something in it just wakes you up to language, for example. So very early on, one of the great stories of the birth of Zeus is how Kronos, who is married to Rhea, his sister, he's a Titan, and he has defeated Uranus, his father. He's gelded him. But in gelding his father, Uranus, he is cursed by his father, who, grabbing his maimed genitals, says, "May you be brought down by your children's, just as I have been brought down by you." And so he's terrified of having children, but he makes love to his wife, Rhea, and each time she gives birth, first to a girl, Hestia, he eats the child, and then to a boy, Hades, he eats that baby, then to another girl, Demeter, eats that, then to another boy, Poseidon, eats that, and then Hera eats her, and then she's pregnant the sixth time. By this time, she hates Kronos, and she devises this plan. She goes to a near Mount Othrys, where the Titans, it's there, Olympus, as it were. It's a kingdom or a province of Greece called Magnesia, near Thessaly, as we would say now. And she finds this stone, and the stones in Magnesia were quite special. The Greeks noticed that iron would be attracted to them. And so they gave this property of the stones from Magnesia the name of Magnesia, which is magnetite, stone of Magnesia, from which we get our word magnet, of course. And not only that, but we get magnesium, the element, and even manganese, the element, through a spelling mistake. So all these kind of things about that, interesting little sidelines, but you wouldn't want to disturb the story of her getting this stone, because she uses the stone in a wonderful, deceptive way. She drapes it in linen and puts it under her thighs and then makes the screams of childbirth, and Kronos comes along and she says, no, don't take this one. And he grabs the swaddled child, as he thinks, and swallows it down, and off he goes. And then she goes to Crete, still pregnant, of course, and gives birth to Zeus, who then gets his revenge on his father. And so the Olympian order is born, and it's a wonderful story. But you want to stop off at things like magnesium, just because it's so interesting, and how much of our language and science derives from Greek words and Greek places that we're not always familiar with. And I think a lot of people, especially curious children, find a thrill in linking words to stories and ideas, that discovering the words aren't always just quite such arbitrary signs.
In the main text, you're addressing the reader directly very frequently, but it feels as if in the footnotes, you're then kind of pulling them aside in a more intimate way. How do you deal with that when you're doing the audiobook?
Good question. That's a very good point. You have to chat with your producer, and you say, now, I think this one we just won't bother with, because it really does get in the way. Or this one we can do at the end of the story, or maybe the end of that chapter, or it may just be a natural paragraph, rather than where I've embedded the footnote in the text in the book. For the audio, one will probably find another place for it. But one has to be constantly thinking of those things.
I want to pause for just a moment and play for our listeners a sample from the audiobook.
Mum, what's a Medusa?
Perseus, have you been drinking?
Maybe. Just a cup or two. A hiccup or two, by the sound of it. No, but seriously, what's a Medusa?
Why do you want to know?
I heard the name and wondered, that's all.
Well, if you'll stop pacing around like a caged lion and sit down, I'll tell you, said Danae.
Medusa, so they say, was a beautiful young woman who was taken and ravished by the sea god Poseidon.
Ravished?
Unfortunately for her, this took place on the floor of a temple sacred to the goddess Athena. She was so angry at the sacrilege that she punished Medusa.
She didn't punish Poseidon.
The gods don't punish each other, at least not very often. They punish us.
And how did Athena punish Medusa?
She transformed her into a gorgon.
Blimey, said Perseus.
And what's a gorgon?
That was an excerpt from the audio edition of Stephen Fry's Heroes. I want to ask specifically about the audio recording, because you mentioned that your original idea of doing the Greek myths was as a play. So did the audio give you that opportunity to bring whatever it was that you had wanted to that version?
It did, yes. I'd pictured that I would do a stage show in which I, you know, sat in an armchair and told the stories. I've always had this slight antipathy towards the almost universally accepted idea that the best fictional mode is showing, not telling. It's a cliche of Hollywood and of even of, you know, school story competitions and so on, is don't tell, show. And sometimes I think telling is better. And I think audiobooks are a good example of how that is the case, how language living in the brain is enough. And I saw this show where I would sit in a chair, because the thing that I think really excites me about Greek myths is this idea of our ancestors thousands of years ago, before writing, but once language had arrived, which is 50,000 years, most people would say. 50,000 years ago, our ancestors, they'd already had tools and fire, and now they had language. And these things protected them enormously because they could plan and they could discuss things with each other and they could make them their lives safer and more secure. So there they are in their cave or their hut, whatever it might be, around a fire. And they've had a hard day's planting and hunting and doing all the other things that they would do. And it's at this point that the children and indeed some of the adults will ask the questions that language allows you to ask. Why does the sun always disappear at the end of the day? Why does the moon come up instead? Or is that the sun looking different? Or why do some mountains rumble with fire? Who brings the rain? Because when there's a force in the world, an agency, you give that agency a name. If you can't explain it, you give it a personality, which is just another way of saying you call it a god. And that's what our ancestors always did. So there was a god of growing, you know, because anything that moved, any force, including leaves coming out of branches, had to be explained. Who pushes those leaves out? And so Demeter, the goddess of growth and fertility, is the responsible for that, and so on. And light comes from Aether or from Apollo. And all of this was telling. It was sitting around telling stories. And those stories are transmitted from brain to brain and mouth to mouth. And yes, there's a certain amount of showing. Some people then do drawings of them and statues and so on. But the statues only really live, only have meaning when someone explains them in language. And in this great rush to be so excited by showing, not telling, and in a culture which is a culture of spectacle, I loved the idea of doing a theatre show, which was actually just talking. And there'd be a few, you know, lights and other things. And indeed, after the first book, Mythos, came out, and while I just was writing Heroes, I did do the show. I did it in Canada at the Shaw Festival in Niagara-on-the-Lake, and then did a tour around Britain. And in fact, I'm due to do it in Australia later this year, though that's obviously all up in the air because of the COVID.
Well, in 2021, let's say.
Yes.
Until then, I urge our listeners to listen to Stephen Fry, tell the stories of heroes, but also to pick up the book and Mythos, because these are really beautifully produced books with incredible artwork. They're like really like gift items. And also to go back and watch that 1997 film Wild, which also features a very young Jude Law. I despised him for so long after he was so terrible as Bosie. I mean, good, terrible. Watch him be jostled very briefly in A Fish Called Wanda, to read one of his many memoirs and his novels. Stephen, it has been such a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thank you. A delight.
Stephen Fry's latest book is called Heroes, The Greek Myths Reimagined.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So here's a request for our listeners. I get lots of feedback from you, some complaints, lots of kind words. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me directly at books@nytimes.com. I will write back. But you can also, if you feel moved to do so, review us on any platform where you download the podcast, whether that's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or somewhere else. Please feel free to review us and, of course, email us at any time. Joining us now, my colleagues Lauren Christensen and Andrew LaValle, to talk a bit about books around race and racism, which is certainly always topical, but perhaps especially topical now. Lauren and Andrew, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Pamela.
Hey, Pamela.
It's been an interesting few weeks, and we are recording this on June 4th. It's been an especially heavy week, and I think a lot of people are asking themselves how they might better inform themselves around issues of race. Certainly, we're seeing on the bestseller list a really kind of sudden influx of titles, not all of them new, related to issues of race in this country. And Lauren, I know you are already reading a book that is one of my favorites, one by a previous guest on the podcast, Isabel Wilkerson. Tell us a little bit about that book.
Right before George Floyd came into the news, I had actually picked up The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration, mostly because I had wanted to read it before reading her next one, which is going to be coming out later this year. And, you know, it's a 600 something page book. And you know, I was intimidated, I confess, to begin it. But once you start, I mean, anyone who's read it, and I know, Pamela, I've heard you talk about it so much in the office, but I didn't expect that I was going to get such a novelistic sort of narrative. It's really the story of three individuals who left the South. One was a sharecropper on a cotton farm. One picked oranges. And then the other actually finished high school. And he was always sort of set apart from his other sort of Southern Black cohorts because he was more educated and he always wanted to be a doctor. And it's these three separate paths that these individuals take, really novelistic narratives of individual people that help you sink in so deeply into the faces behind this really mass phenomenon. And I think it's a really effective way to tell the story of how, you know, this wasn't a conscious movement. I mean, this is just a, you know, an amalgamation of individual choices that each, you know, single person made, and a really difficult calculation that they had to make, which was it safer to stay or safer to leave? And that just amalgamation of the individual choices is a really powerful narrative to be reading right now. You know, it's not just about, quote unquote, addressing the moment. You know, I obviously understand that, you know, reading is not any kind of activism, but just building a sense of understanding that a single reader might not have had before picking up the book. I think books do that better than really any other form that I know of. It's one thing for us at the Times because we have these conversations a lot, but you know, some readers might not have that opportunity to, you know, be exposed to multiplicity of ideas. So reading these books is a great window out, I think.
One of the things I think she did in that book that was so effective, and you talk about the narrative component, is that she takes those three individual stories and through those lives, she's telling this much bigger story. She follows. I mean, what's so incredible to me in terms of structure and the work that she had to do as a historian and as a journalist to piece these together is that she's following three major lines of the Great Migration. You know, she follows one that's an eastern path, one that goes west through the South, through Texas, and then over to California. And then this one middle strand that ends up in the cities of Chicago and Detroit. And just the act of finding those three stories that were able to embody so much of these larger things that were going on. You know, you had to sort of change your whole way of working as you crossed the line from the segregated South to the North. It's just amazing to me that she was able to find the right people to tell the stories. And I think that one of the things for me as a reader that made it so powerful and that I think probably informs the kinds of or characterizes the kinds of books that I personally find the most powerful when reading about issues of race and identity is that it is about the individual. It's about that the personal details of someone's life, whether it's in a memoir like the autobiography of Malcolm X or Coming of Age in the Mississippi, or in a novel or in history. It's those ones that really focus on people that, for me at least, are most powerful. But Andrew, you read a lot of very different, I mean, I know that you've been reading a lot of poetry recently.
Yes. And one of the ones that I'm reading right now is a book that came out a couple of years ago called American Sonnets for My Past and Future Assassin by Terrence Hayes. He was a National Book Award finalist in 2018 for this book, and he wrote it during the first 200 days of the Trump presidency. Something that I really love about poetry is that I think, particularly coming at it as a journalist, I'm really focused on words, on sort of using words to convey information. And for me, poetry helps me remember that words can do all sorts of other different things, and that expressing things that are hard to express is also important, and conveying feeling. And I get that from poetry in a way that I don't always get from prose or nonfiction writing. And I think Hayes is doing it. I wouldn't call it a book about race, but I think he's exploring race in a really valuable way. I've been reading a lot of poetry lately that I think is doing this in all sorts of different ways. You know, people like Claudia Rankine, Dennis Smith, Jericho Brown, Reginald Dwayne Betts. And then another book that I'm reading, this is a novel, which is another one that I don't think would be described as a book about race, but it's given me a lot to think about. It's called Days of Distraction by Alexandra Chang. It came out a couple months ago, and it is centered on an Asian American journalist in San Francisco who is not really loving her job. And when her boyfriend decides to move upstate New York for grad school, she decides to quit and move with him. But as the book goes on, you get inside her head as she's thinking about what it will be like to live somewhere where there are fewer people who look like her. She starts thinking a lot about what it is to be in an interracial relationship and whether she's sort of part of some dynamics that she didn't really sign up for. And so that's been really interesting to read, especially over these past couple of weeks also.
So here's where I confess that I also watch what you're reading on Instagram, especially now that we're not in the office and we don't get to have as many in-person conversations. And I noticed that you posted as well another collection of poetry, Homie.
Yes, Homie by Dinez Smith. I think I've been turning to poetry a lot lately because, for one thing, this is probably a bad thing for a book's editor to say, but I've been having some trouble kind of focusing on novels lately. And so I've been sort of going back to poetry as something that I can read and that I can sort of, for whatever reason, can take in a little more easily right now. But I also really seek out books that I think will push me in my thinking a little bit. That's something I always want in my reading. And so people like Smith and Jericho Brown and Claudia Rankine, I feel like I'm finding their work really valuable these days.
One of the things I find, and maybe this is the sort of history dork in me, but I read fewer contemporary voices. And what I find, surprising and to a certain extent pretty depressing is that when you go back to James Baldwin and Toni Morrison, and especially now that we have a lot of their interviews and spoken pieces available on YouTube, you go back and you look at those clips, you read those clips or you read their work and you realize really nothing has changed. I mean, not that much has changed, certainly, that the same things that they're talking about then apply now. Both of them, of course, are no longer with us. And I'm curious if there are classic books that either of you have turned back to or are thinking about.
Well, personally, a couple of months ago, I spoke to Britt Bennett about her recently published novel, her second, called The Vanishing Half. And there are so many echoes of Toni Morrison in that novel. So it really brought me back to all of the reading that I had done last summer after Toni Morrison passed. And just the notion of passing in general is really a theme in this new novel by Britt Bennett about two twin sisters. They're light-skinned Black women from Jim Crow era Louisiana, and one decides to estrange herself from the family and moves across the country to California and lives as a white woman and begins a family with a white man and has a daughter who she never tells is part Black. And the other twin marries a much darker skinned Black man, has a very dark skinned daughter. And it's this cleaving of essentially one entity into two very different lives based on passing or not. And it brought me back to the classic Nella Larsen book called Passing, which has been recently reissued, as well as, you know, echoes of Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye and Tar Baby and Sula and so much of her work, this notion of race as a choice that some people get to make and that others don't for entirely physical reasons, but that really make a measurable difference in their economic lives, in their ability to just live freely and happily. I consider Toni Morrison classics, but definitely those books are really on my mind right now. Andrew, how about you?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. One book that I have just started, and I checked it out from the library right before all the physical libraries in New York closed down, is No No Boy by John Okada.
Oh, I've been wanting to read that.
Yeah, me too. And we had written about some of the turmoil around the publication of the book itself last year, and I had sort of been feeling guilty that I had never read it. So I'm just starting it now, and it's basically about a Japanese-American man sort of returning to Seattle after he's been in an internment camp. And I haven't finished it yet, so I can't sort of spell out the plot, but it's kind of exploring this idea of like being neither from here nor there, being American but not being seen as American, and sort of that struggle that I think a lot of Asian Americans can identify with.
Can you explain to listeners what this idea of no-no meant? Because I had not come across it until reading George Takei's graphic memoir that came out a couple years ago.
It came from a sort of questionnaire that was given to Japanese Americans in the internment camps around World War II. The first question was if they were willing to serve in the U.S. Armed Forces. And the second question was, if you swear allegiance to the U.S. and forswear allegiance to Japan. And if you answer no to both questions, then, and you are male, then the sort of epithet was that you were a no-no boy.
Lauren, do you also have library books sitting around that you took out and you haven't yet returned? Because Andrew, when you mentioned that, I think I have this big pile and they're like sitting right by the front door. And I feel like I have this like childhood like feeling of like, oh no, every time I see them.
I actually don't, but it's funny because a bunch of my friends, they always come over to my house and borrow, you know, quote, borrow from my library. And now I'm just like, I'm never getting those books back. You know, they all have my stuff sort of checked out. And I'm like, well, see you never. But I'm happy. I'm happy that they're in good hands.
All right. Well, a very dark moment. A little bit of levity at the end of this is obviously a really tough time. But I appreciate both of you coming on and talking about these books. Lauren, Andrew, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Alexandra Alter joins us now with some news from the publishing world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
It's been a while.
Yes, I had a nice week off. I hope you guys had a good week too, working.
It's been an interesting week. What's going on in the publishing world?
Well, so much is going on that I don't even really know where to start. I mean, there's been an incredible response among writers and editors and agents to the protest movement, and there's kind of a movement building in publishing to make things more equitable. As we saw, there was this hashtag on Twitter, publishing paid me, where authors were revealing what their advances were. And a lot of authors were pointing to significant disparities between what a white author would get for a book advance versus an author of color. There was also action taken by people working in the industry. People signed a petition and took a day off and donated proceeds to various causes to say, you know, we would like to see more diversity in our own ranks. You know, people that work at the biggest five publishing companies, as well as diversity among the books that we publish, and, you know, more equitable pay for authors of color. So there's a lot happening on that front. On top of that, the publishing industry is still kind of reeling from the effects of the pandemic and the shutdown. And we've just gotten the first picture of what April looked like. April was the first month bookstores were shut down entirely for the most part for the full month. You know, in March, they were open for a couple of weeks typically. And it did have an impact on sales, even though many readers were finding alternate ways to find books. The numbers from the Association of American Publishers showed a fairly significant fall, particularly for adult books. Sales fell 8% in April compared to the previous year. But young adult and children's was up by 4%. So overall, the decline was about 3.5%. Not catastrophic. I mean, when you're looking at publishing compared to other sectors of the economy, it's actually pretty good. And when you look at the first 4 months of the year, actually, sales were flat. So publishers do have a bit to make up for having lost those sales in April, but it seems like overall they've weathered it pretty well. The other thing that the numbers from April showed were, this is to be expected given the fact that physical stores were closed, there was a significant jump in ebook revenues. And this is notable because ebooks sales have been falling month over month and for a couple of years now. So ebook revenues were up by 10% compared to April 2019.
All right. Well, I guess neutral to slightly bad news is today's good news.
Exactly.
Alexandra, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now to talk about what we're reading, my colleagues Tina Jordan and Greg Coles. Hi, guys.
Hey, Pamela.
Hi, Pamela.
Greg, let's start with you. What are you reading right now?
I'm reading Flannery O'Connor's only essay collection. It's called Mystery and Manners, and it is subtitled Occasional Prose. I called it an essay collection, but it also includes speeches that she gave and sort of op-eds that she wrote throughout her very short life. O'Connor, you may know, died when she was just 39 years old of lupus. The book is divided into sections without subtitles, but you can kind of glean the purpose behind the organization. The first essays all sort of address writing, regional writing. There's her very famous essay on the grotesque in Southern fiction. So that's all on the nature of writing. There's regional writing in the South. And then a section on reading and teaching literature. There's an essay in there that I think you would enjoy very much, Pamela, called Total Effect and the Eighth Grade, in which she comes down in favor, not of censorship in reading assignments, but in giving children a deep foundation for literature before you start introducing modern literature to them. She's talking about the John Hersey novel, A Bell for Adano, which some people were protesting was too mature for eighth graders. And she says, it's not that it's too mature for them. They should be able to read whatever they want, but they should have the context to understand it. And to get that, you need to go back and read the best of what American literature has to offer from the past. And to understand that, you have to go back even further. And so she's making the case for a very traditional curriculum building in that essay. And then the final section of it is devoted to religion. Flannery O'Connor very famously was Irish Catholic growing up in the Protestant South. She's from Georgia. She struggled not with Catholicism. She was very devout, but struggled with the conflict, as she saw it, between Catholicism and literature. Her responsibilities as a Catholic and her responsibilities as an artist to tell the truth as she saw it. And so she wrote a number of essays sort of trying to reconcile those to figure out what she could write about, what she should write about, whether she had any obligation to her faith in her writing. And that's where I am in the book right now is talking about the role of being a novelist and a believer at the same time.
Have you read all of her short stories?
I've read everything she's written except for this book.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, I've read a number of the essays in this book in anthologies, but I've never read this book straight through cover to cover. Instead of reading fiction, which is my usual preference, I was in the mood to read somebody thinking about fiction, to read actual criticism.
You know, Greg, if we were in the office, I would say to you, can I borrow that when you're done?
Well, I can mail it.
No, that's all right.
Greg has borrowed a couple of my books that he, I think, probably is assuming he'll never have to give back. I have that big white paperback complete Flannery O'Connor stories that I've sort of intended to read.
With the peacock on the cover.
Yes. Yeah. I feel like there's certain like covers that, you know, just everyone knows, like everyone knows that red collected John Cheever story, yeah. You know, like uh-huh. We all have that same one. Which stories are your favorite? I'm curious, because it's a little bit daunting to sort of go right in and plow through the whole thing. Or is that what you're going to tell me I should do?
You should absolutely do that. But she wrote a lot of stories considering how young she was when she died. But I think that her best stories are all the ones that are most widely anthologized, that you read as in high school, certainly in college, English classes, A Good Man is Hard to Find, Good Country People, the Bible Salesman, The Misfit. Oh, gosh. You know, I'm throwing out like little remnants of remembered Flannery O'Connor without being entirely confident of which comes from where.
Tina, do you have a favorite?
I have not read all of Flannery O'Connor, but I, like Greg, love A Good Man is Hard to Find.
Of course, that's the one story I've read, or know that I've read. I think I've read a few, but Tina, what are you reading?
So I'm reading a book by Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind. Subtitle is Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And this is a book I bought after the election when I decided I needed to understand my country better. I read What's the Matter with Kansas? I read the Arlie Hochschild, Strangers in Their Own Land. I bought this. I can't remember who recommended it to me, and I hadn't picked it up until now. And I'm making my way through. I'm about a third of the way through. And Haidt is a social psychologist, and his point isn't that the people on the other side of the political spectrum from a person, it's not that they don't reason. They do reason, but their arguments are supporting their conclusions. His point, it seems so obvious, is that reason isn't impartial at all. It's how we justify our decisions. And he actually compares moral systems to cuisines. He says, we acquire morals like we acquire our taste for food, you know, starting with what we've been given first. And I will say, like, in contradiction to Strangers in Their Own Land, this book to me is making a very different argument as to why people vote the way they do and why some people might vote, as a liberal would think, against their own self-interest. And what he's saying is, no, people aren't voting against their own self-interest. They're voting for their moral interests. And he says, if you're a liberal and you're looking down at somebody who's conservative, saying that they're voting against their own self-interest, he says that you're so convinced of your own rationality that you're not seeing that they think they're being rational too. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, there was another book, I think it actually may be forthcoming, you and I both read about, Tina, as editors, I know, which argued that people vote by feeling and that they can often say, you know, I'm either voting for this person or that person. And the two people have diametrically opposite policy suggestions.
I mean, I know you could also make the argument that liberals voting for higher taxes to support social programs are voting against their self-interests because they're voting to give themselves higher taxes because of their moral beliefs. So that argument works both ways.
It does work both ways. It's just making me think about all of this in a slightly different way. Which is a good thing, always.
Jonathan Haidt co-wrote, I believe, another book in which he and his co-author sort of looked into what is it that distinguishes conservatives from liberals. Do you know the book that I'm talking about?
I don't, but now I want to find everything he's written, honestly.
Yeah, this sounds really interesting. Tina, maybe when we're done, we can do a book exchange through the mail.
I know.
I think that sounds...
You guys go ahead to the USPS.
I just feel the need to read about empathy right now. We're at this tough place in this country, and I just want to do all the reading I can.
In that regard, it's interesting reading Flannery O'Connor right now because she lived in Georgia in the 60s. She died, I think, just after the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And she's silent on the question. I think the best you can say is that she just didn't pay any attention to it. Wasn't hostile, but didn't pay any attention to it. And it feels like sort of a, especially reading her at this moment in America, it feels like a lack in her worldview.
Right.
Pamela, what are you reading?
Well, I'm going to say that I believe that all reading is at its core an act of empathy because you're entering into someone else's mind through their words. But the book I just finished was Ted Chiang's first collection, Stories of Your Life and Others. And listeners of this podcast heard me rave many times about his later collection, Exhalation, which was one of our 10 best books of 2019. And just before the pandemic, I was sent a copy of this earlier book. I think a lot of people went back to this book after the movie Arrival came out because this includes the story of your life, which was the basis of that movie. And I have to confess that was, of course, part of me. It's the fourth story in this collection of eight stories. And part of me was like, I just want to get to Story of Your Life because I need to know.
You could have read it first, Pamela. You don't need to read in order.
Greg, I am like a schoolgirl in that respect. I never look at the last page either. Do you? Do you guys look at the last page?
Oh, I skip all over the place in my reading. Yeah.
I know.
All right. We're going to have to take this up at some point. But in the meantime, no, I read it in order and I was very happy. You know, like all story collections, it's a little bit uneven. There were two stories that I didn't love, but the other ones I thought were really strong. And it starts off with a story called Tower of Babylon, which offers this kind of alternate cosmology in which it was a little bit reminiscent, actually, of the first story of Exhalation, in that it's told in a kind of fable-like way. And this story is about a world in which a huge tower is being built in Babylon. And the tower is intended to get up to the vault of heaven and then crack through that ceiling and go onto the other side. And you're reading it, and it's very intricate. It's at once very meticulous and detailed in terms of how this world works. Ted Chiang does this thing that I think a lot of science fiction writers do, in which they have certain aspects which are very modern and even futuristic, often combined. It's like a steampunk thing with things that are, like, you know, antiquated and from the past. And this story is like that, in that the people of Babylon have built this enormous tower and it extends miles and miles and miles up into the sky. And you're thinking, oh no, what's going to happen when they get to the top and they realize like they're just going to keep going. But I will spoil a little bit that story in that, no, there is a vault and they do have to indeed crack their way through it. You know, what I love about Ted Chiang's story is they are always thought-provoking. And I love that he has story notes at the end, which talks about the impetus for the story. It tells the reader what it is that he's trying to accomplish. And I'll just talk about two other stories, although it's hard not to talk about all of them. But the next one is a kind of Flowers for Algernon-like premise, where you have someone who has been granted a kind of super intelligence. And what was most confounding about that story is that you think, okay, you keep thinking, I know where this is going to go. It's going to go either here or it's going to go there. But if it did, it would end in three pages and there are 40 more pages in the story. So it kind of keeps you thinking and wondering how it can possibly go beyond that. The most interesting reading experience I had in this collection, though, was with that story, Story of Your Life, The Basis of Arrival, which I have to say I have never had with a book before. And I feel really disconcerted by it. And I'm wondering if you guys have ever had the same experience.
So Arrival, the movie, which was a Denis Villeneuve film with Jeremy Renner and Amy Adams, is one of my favorite science fiction movies of all time, yeah. If not even one of my favorite movies. I just think it's an exquisite movie, and I've seen it at least 4 times. It is so embedded in my head. And I, you know, Ted Chiang came on this podcast and he talked about the differences, the things that the filmmaker added, but I didn't really know that until I read the story. And I could not get the movie out of my head reading the story. I could not just push it aside and read the story for itself. It kept intruding on my image of the story, my understanding of my appreciation. And I, in fact, felt very disappointed by the story.
By the story. Oh, that's so interesting.
It's so rare to be disappointed for me. It's rare to be disappointed by the work on paper that when it is, in fact, the inspiration for another work. It's doubly confounding, and I don't think has ever happened that I could not get that the movie or the play or whatever it might be out of my head. I could not appreciate it on its own.
I wonder if some part of that is because most movies that are adapted from literary works are adapted from novels. And so they necessarily cut things out to kind of streamline and fit into the space of 2 hours or, you know, an hour and a half, whatever the feature length is. But adapting from a short story to make it work as a movie, you almost have to add things and it becomes richer that way. And obviously it's a more visual medium. I wonder if you're just reacting to that what you're reading feels more like a sketch.
Well, it's a contrast to a story that I talked about a few weeks ago that I read, and I can't remember, Craig, if you were in that conversation on the fly.
Yes.
I mean, I was able to get the film out. It was different enough. And in fact, it was fascinating, the differences. And then immediately, or not immediately, but maybe after a page or two, I sort of cast the film aside and was like, okay, this needs to be taken on its own terms because it's something else. It's something other from what the movie. But the Denis Villeneuve film, I think, was faithful enough to the spirit, if different enough in the execution, that it just like, everything blurred and I couldn't take it out. What about you, Tina? Huh. Have you had this?
I haven't had the exact experience you're talking about, but I am wondering if a little time will make this any better for you, because sometimes when movie versions get or TV versions get conflated, you know, as I'm reading a print version, I have to allow time and come back to it later, because the very best film adaptations make you think about the story or the novel in a different way. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I don't usually like the film better. So, in fact, I'm struggling to remember a time when I did.
Well, I challenge you to read this story. Have you seen the film?
I've seen the film. I love it. So now I need to go read the story, obviously.
All right, that's the assignment. I want to hear what you guys think on a future episode.
Is the story also called Arrival?
Called Story of Your Life, which I think is a really brilliant title, given what we know about that. You know, I feel bad. If listeners here are not familiar with either, you have no idea what I'm talking about. But suffice to say that it's a story about language, about linguistics, and it involves aliens. And I think if I say anything more than that, I'm going to spoil your own enjoyment of both. So I will leave it there. Let's run down the books that we're reading again, starting with you, Greg.
I'm reading Mystery and Manners, Occasional Prose by Flannery O'Connor.
And I'm reading The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion by Jonathan Haidt.
And I just read Stories of Your Life and Others by Ted Chiang. Greg, Tina, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.